Bonjour et bienvenue à Portrait Vivant, l'émission radio qui esquisse un tableau en mouvement de la communauté artistique de l'École d'art de Sutton. Ensemble, allons à la rencontre des artistes, des jeunes créateurs et des œuvres qui façonnent cette institution incontournable du paysage culturel de l'Estrie. Je m'appelle Ayona, artiste en art visuel. Mon parcours m'a menée aux quatre coins du monde, guidée par une quête d'apprentissage et de rencontres. J'ai fini par m'installer ici, en Estrie, où je découvre une véritable boîte au trésor de personnes engagées, passionnées par leur travail, avec des valeurs d'entraide et de coopération. Dans cet épisode, nous découvrons l'exposition « Drap de lit pour une humanité en devenir », une rétrospective consacrée à l'œuvre de Peter Schumann, fondateur du légendaire Bread and Puppet Theatre.
The ultimate atrocity and the kids smashed limbs and the parents and grandparents, brothers, sisters, shattered lives. How?
Cette exposition monumentale, présentée par l'École d'art de Sutton, m'a profondément touchée. Par ses grands drapins, marionnettes gigantesques et films d'archives, ainsi que par les performances émouvantes du Bread and Puppet Theatre.
How much longer?
Who wins?
Is this right?
No.
What?
No.
What?
No.
How?
How much longer?
Son art, qui met en lumière les complexités de la guerre, résonne profondément avec mes propres expériences et m'a amené à réfléchir intensément sur le pouvoir de l'art à interroger les enjeux les plus urgents de notre époque. Aujourd'hui, nous aurons le privilège de dialoguer avec celles et ceux qui ont fait vivre cette exposition. Peter Schumann, artiste et fondateur du Bread and Puppet Theatre du Vermont. Vicky Tanzi, artiste et organisatrice de l'exposition. Alexis Smith, commissaire et marionnettiste du Bread and Puppet depuis près de 40 ans. Et Yves Chérif, historien du cirque et collaborateur de longue date du Cirque du Soleil. À travers le récit, nous verrons comment l'art devient un portrait vivant de notre monde, un miroir de nos luttes, de nos espoirs, et de nos engagements. Restez avec nous pour une exploration de l'art comme force de transformation et de mémoire collective.
How can we, with our proud little humanity, ripped from us by the culture of hubris, how can our mind produce the weapons we need against this hypocrisy? How?
J'ai eu le privilège de visiter Peter Schumann, fondateur du Bread and Puppet Theatre. Je suis lié au Vermont, accompagné par l'artiste sutonaise Vicky Tanzi. À travers des performances alliant musique, marionnettes et satire sociale, Peter nous parle de la force de l'art populaire et du concept d'écoute irrationnelle, un moyen puissant pour dire l'indicible.
The ranting, it's a method of speech that liberates your brain to be musical rather than intellectual. And makes it possible to say bolder things right into the faces of people who don't want to listen to them. so you just do it.
How can we, neighbors of ultimate fascism, we neighbors of ultimate fascism, resulting from perfect collaboration of all segments of our proud Western civilization, academia, media.
In a way, they can't help it, but it's irrational, because they're doing an irrational listening.
Right.
So that helps them over their thresholds that are educated into them.
It's like bypassing the left brain.
What a great phrase, irrational listening.
Well, they can.
Irrational listening.
They all of a sudden have to.
Yeah.
Because it's a dictator with a thing, bum, 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 bum. And forces them to listen in unlikely ways, yeah.
So when did you first start doing
it? It's a combination of, it's not just this, it's what we call cheap art, which we invented in response to something that Exxon and Mobil pushed for in the 80s, where they had big one-page New York Times advertising for how good art is for business. So we said, aha, is it really so good? We said the opposite of that, art is not only no good for business, but art from now on is cheap. And then, they realized what a stupidity that was. I don't think they ever realized it. They're still using it the same way, and that's why we call it, modern art is bullshit, because it serves the system as it exists without questioning it, without even touching it, without respect for the whole population. It's just, unless you get an interpreter to go with each individual person, there's nothing to it. It really means a nothingness. And it's proud of it, too. It proudly presents nothing. So when you paint on the bedsheet, you're obliged to paint about what has been in the bed before. And you have to figure it out. Oh, my God, what slept there? Mm-hmm. What died there? What was born in there? It's all in there. Can't help it. So that's when you, the same thing when you pick up cardboard boxes and use them as painting material, to carve them up and utilize them, make purposes for them. What are they good for, the little pancakes that you paint? What are they? You have to invent the purposes. Right? One is for when your grandpa dies, the other one is when your baby brother is born, the next one is for when you go shopping, the next one is when you come back from shopping and they're tired, etc. You have to invent the whole thingy for it. And we, our first cheap art things in that year, whatever it was, the 80s sometime, we made busloads, our school busloads, full of little pancake-like pictures. And then we took it to the towns around here, and then we realized that the kids coming out of school, they went bottle collecting and sold their bottles and brought that money to buy cheap art.
Oh, wow.
That was a neat experience.
What a beautiful
to see
exchange.
That. Yeah.
En visite chez Peter, dans les collines du Northeast Kingdom du Vermont, il nous a offert un bon café noir et une discussion sur son concept de l'écoute irrationnelle, sa philosophie du cheap art ainsi que sa rejection de l'art moderne. Il a poursuivi en nous expliquant ses débuts comme marionnettiste et la raison pour laquelle il trouve cette forme d'art si puissante.
So, puppetry, my parents happen to be friends with puppeteers, so a typical Christmas present for a kid was a puppet, a handcuffed puppet, beautiful handcuffed puppet. And then what do you have? Then when we put a blanket over two chairs and we did hand puppet shows. And the event of fleeing, when we were bombarded by the Allies, and had to figure out, my parents, so they ran again and again to the train station and again, and unpack red dick things, put them into the garden, they hide them, whatever it is, again and again and again and again. But they made a permission for each kid to take a little bag. Mm-hmm. And my choice was the hand puppets. Mm-hmm. So I took those, you know. Then we fled. We ended up in a little village on the Baltic Sea near Denmark. And I just knocked out the village doors and have them come. They had a communal room there for the villagers. And I did hand puppet shows, probably assisted by my younger brother. I have to ask him if that's still true. But anyway, and it's not, but you don't have to make up anything, because what you have is the reality. Yeah, you know, you have a king, you have a gravedigger, you have a ghost, you have a robber, you have a princess, you have a cop, etc. All the archetypes of bourgeois life. And then you don't have to worry about the story, because just how do you assemble it? Well, is the gravedigger first, or is the murderer first,
yeah,
to make a thing, or what? It's all it is, balancing which puppets you use next. So easy.
Did you make it up as you went?
Totally, yeah, yes. No rehearsals ever.
Right.
In England it's Pons, in Russia Petrushka, very similar characters that are needed to ridiculize the system, the above system, whatever the state, church, whatever it is. They need to be ridiculed for their existence. Mm. And it all comes out of the same thing, out of carnival. Carnival was an invitation for the population to be free for a week or two. Mm-hmm. And to throw shit at the cardinal. An invitation to do so was allowed, couldn't be punished, and they did it. And that's the beginning of how population empowers itself. The church had already pretty, within the mystery cycles exist in English literature, in German, in France, in Italy, all over the place. And they were very elaborate in the 15th century, very elaborate. What happened there? Leonardo worked for mystery cycle things, you know, made designs for them, Deus Ex Machina, all these devil scenes and mystical appearances, the clouds in the cathedral, all this stuff. And then, I don't know which pope decided, finished. Too much devils, too much stuff, out of there. And that's when the marketplace started, in front of the cathedral. Mm. That's where people started bringing their veggies and everything they had out there, and the Kasper and the Guignol and everybody came out, and everybody sang. And they invented the secret language, that's the swazl, that also comes from Persia. It's a device that you put in your mouth to distort your voice.
Oh.
So when the cops come, you employ it, and they can never charge you with anything, because you can distort it sufficiently, and they can't say, no, I told you I beat up the cop. And he said, no, I know you.
Wow.
So wow. It's a huge thing. You know, it's the real origin of popular art as a means of all-round revolution, all-around revolution, not just peasant revolutions. Those were prevalent in the starting in the 15th century, very pronounced. Engels wrote a book of them, about them. So they were huge, the peasant revolutions. Yeah, that's how it was. That's how it goes. That's puppetry. Mm.
It makes me think of how in so many countries where a writer is imprisoned because they have written in a form of writing, in a literature, things that are not acceptable. Mm-hmm. And so they're banned or they're kicked out or they're put in prison. And so art being used this way, whether it's film or pantomime, I mean, there's so much, there are so many ways to address the deep underbelly of what's going on out there through this form, which, as you're saying, can be, there's a kind of a combination of disguise, but at the same time, truth that's coming through it. And if it's too brazen, if it's too direct, too naming it, that's more dangerous. So then you take on the character, well, I'm just the gravedigger.
But since jail is so desirable, why not? Yeah. It's free food.
Yeah, yeah. So art is so essential as a language to address what matters. And humor, of course, too. Humor and playfulness. It's Did you get all that?
Yeah, so good.
Translation, please.
That's the way it is. I told you everything from beginning to end. Yeah, it's amazing that I get it now. I do. I'm really glad you explained that to me. I understand how the move from archetype and then moving around in this world and you're seeing the archetypes and you're seeing like the caricature. And it feeds into your art, and that's what also makes it so accessible to other people, and like for a child to understand.
You're so right. The translation, the continuous need to retranslate archetypes, because society, they're always the same, but they change names.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
As we go from the 80s to the 90s, same old bourgeoisie, same old need for archetypes.
Yeah.
But names changes, you know.
Yes, so. And I think we get caught in the conversation and the logic and all of the detail, and people get confused. And when you're like, this is the gravedigger is the gravedigger, murderer is the murderer, and so it really brings it home. And I think that's what I found so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Going to your Palestine mass, it was like, straight in the heart. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and because a gravedigger needs a job. So somebody has to be careful.
Fair. Fair enough.
And what's a good one to kill might be the king, for example. A good idea. Kill him and then the gravedigger had a huge job. Wonderful.
Finalement, Peter nous décrit sa surprise en arrivant à son exposition rétrospective au Québec, à l'École d'art de Satine, et se rendant compte que la salle était pleine à craquer d'enthousiastes, de fans, de supporters de son travail.
Surprised that a little town like Sutton could yield a big audience like that and also could yield as much interest in subject matter as is apparent when you are confronted with hardcore political slogans.
Yeah.
Anti-capitalistic and all the rest of it. So that was very refreshing. Very nice. That's not commonly so, I would say. You know, what do you normally do? Universities, relatively boring. As you know, it's very fascistic now. Mm-hmm. The university system in America is in Canada is bad. I mean, in America it's forbidden. People, you lose credits for schooling for mention of all the lobbyists.
That
you know.
Is shocking.
Yeah. It's money.
So much for really encouraging people to use their minds to feel that they can say whatever they...
Right, and
they media. Can. Money industry and centuries of genocide. How?
L'univers de Peter Schumann et du Bread and Puppet Theatre est celui d'une pratique artistique radicale, où l'art devient un instrument de transformation sociale. L'influence de ce mouvement va bien au-delà du Vermont. Et c'est ici, au Québec, que nous retrouvons des artistes comme Vicky Tandy, qui portent cette même sensibilité. Vicky, une artiste multidisciplinaire sautonnaise et collaboratrice de longue date avec le théâtre, a participé activement à des projets comme Bed Sheets for the Night.
Ah oui, et pour moi, c'est comme ça que je travaille. Je dois être, sentir touchée. Je dois avoir une expérience personnelle. Et chaque fois que je fasse une résidence d'artiste quelque part, je vais sans plan, sans idée en avance, parce que mon plan, c'est de réagir à ce que je vis. So it's like, whoa, scary, because you don't know what you're going to make.
C'est le vide.
Even if you're going to make anything, what's it going to be? And then, when you're wide open like that, things start coming through you, because you're giving it that opportunity.
Yeah, and you're not letting your kind of ego or your plan sort of dictate and control what's happening. You're yes. sort of just allowing the present moment to sort of manifest itself.
Yeah, right? Because why not? Why otherwise just stay home and make your work in your studio? Why put yourself in a situation that you don't know anything about the place? You don't yeah. know, it's a different, you're challenged, and yet you're able to respond from that part of you mm-hmm. that there is no other place like that. And it's a particular personal quality of presence and language.
Absolutely. And I think that this is something that I feel that you have in common with Peter.
How so?
I think from the Bread and Puppet, because he really holds the space.
Yeah.
And it's like these very magnetic artists that really, they're on their X, they're on their sort of raison d'être, their real authentic place mm-hmm. and I think it creates an energy that moves people.
Yeah.
And I think we witness that with your work, and we witness that with the performances that we witnessed in the past couple of weeks with the Bread and Puppet and Peter's, you know, sort of almost like no filter.
Yeah.
Completely like putting his heart out, and it comes out, and it can be beautiful, it could be scary, it can be even
disturbing.
Grotesque, yeah. disturbing, yeah. but there's in there, there's so much love.
Yeah.
There's so much love for humanity and for people.
And dedication.
And dedication. Yes. So yes. it's like a way to serve.
Yes, yes. And you are like a vehicle. You allow things to come through you. And because you are who you are, with the history that you have of using a language that is creative, whether it's visual, verbal, sound, gesture, you're inviting that to come through you, and it becomes so personalized. And at the same time, it's not, as you were saying, it's not about your own ego. You're having to actually let go of that, because there's no guarantee. And so you're stepping off into space without a plan, without a parachute, and yet you're doing it. Like, why? Well, it's what you are here to do, basically.
Incredible. And I wonder, Vicky, did you get influenced in your way of thinking from your experience in Vermont? Like, what are your influences that sort of got you to this very beautiful and very authentic place of your artistic expression?
Well, for me, Bread and Puppet, I encountered them for the first time as an audience member probably in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And I started working with them soon after that. And I would work part-time. I'd go down for a week, or I'd go, you know, I couldn't live there because I have a had a family. My daughter, one of my daughters, when she was six, was performing with the Bread and Puppet on little tiny stilts, you know, because they're very inclusive of every age and every talent, every personality. Oofed. Because when you look at his work, not only do you see where he takes his political thoughts and attitudes, but you also see, you know, here he has banners that are dedicated to a cloud or to a carrot, you know, or a cup. And you're going, it all matters. It's not like taking one over the other and saying one's much more important. They're both important. So for me, working with Bread and Puppet allowed me to start to bring in my work. I was creating theater pieces, and I still do, that was working with difficult subject matter, war, the news. I would have sometimes a cast, an ensemble of maybe 15 or 16 people. But I also was really wanting to work with people who could bring something of their own to it, which is what he does. Everyone feels things. Everybody, you know, I can remember doing this piece on the news, and I thought, for the longest time as an artist, I thought, I'm an artist. I have nothing to do with politics. That's a whole other world. Yes. I don't want to know.
The silo, the different silos, yeah. Where does I understand that, and I understand. It's like a way to protect your own sacred.
And you also, though, but you also don't know, you can't affect the political environment very much. And so I thought, well, better just to keep out of it. And then I thought, but I'm so aware of it all the time, every
so
day.
So much.
I have to find a way to let it inform my work, to come through my work, so I can touch things that I find disturbing. And I don't want to be a proselytizer. I don't want to be like, you know, shouting,
moralizing,
saying you got to do this.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah,
what,
yeah, yeah.
I don't want to be
course.
A preacher. No. I want to create a kind of almost like a poetry that people read in their own way. And so, yes, I finally found a way to marry my everyday life. Plus, I've also been a Buddhist for a long time, and my practice is about presence and being awake and being still, all of those combined. And that really has a lot to do with the fact that I'm an improviser as a performer, because you have to be present, and you have no safety net. You have nothing to hold on to. You have no like, oh, wait, I'll take this out of my pocket. I've got this great little piece that I can do because I am prepared. No preparation. I don't allow myself that. I you're not going to do that. That's going to change the game. You're going to change the rules and you're going to be in control.
I think a lot of people would find this very brave, but also very risky.
It's definitely
like the kind of act of doing things while scared.
Absolutely.
And that's where you get the strongest sort of essential, I don't know, expression.
Yes,
somehow.
And it becomes your way of, becomes your modus operandi. You really, that's the kind of, if you want your life to be meaningful as the artist you are, as the human being that you are, as the person with, we've got all sorts of emotions from confusion and like attitude and judgment. But you step into the art making and a lot of that just kind of, there's no room for it. It dissolves unless you want to be a big, you know, everything you want to have like in people's faces in a way that no question. I want them to walk away wondering. It's like what I said to Ed when he asked me, what do you want people to walk away from when they come with, when they see this show? I said, I want them to walk away with wonder. Rather, you know, because it leaves it open. It leaves it alive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do, actually, I really see a parallel with the exhibit that you, you know, you brought Bread and Puppet to the Sutton School of Art. Thank you so much.
Yes,
you did.
Yes.
And because you are a longtime collaborator with them. And I do see a similarity with the sense of wonder, awe, emotion. You know, we all walked away from that Bedsheets for Humanity, from the show, with a really renewed perspective and a sense of questioning ourselves and our role, and am I doing enough? Should I be doing something differently? You know, and I do think that this is some of the most powerful art that can really transform and people who might just be walking by and not even have an expectation. They don't know Vicky Tandy. They don't know, you know, Peter Schumann. They don't know. And they just kind of walk in and they were so overwhelmed.
Oh, yeah.
And I think in this particular exhibit, because of the scale, right? There's just so much. Yeah. It was like all enveloping. Was that something that you planned, like to create that experience?
Well, I knew what his work is like. And he does not, as you know, he does not concern himself about perfect technical rendering of things, even though he probably could do it with his eyes closed. But he chooses to use a language, a visual language and style or that is so accessible to children as well as adults. There's no particular group of people that can only get it. Everybody gets it.
Right.
And it's raw. It's pretty raw. And he just wants to get it out there. He just wants to put it out there. He's not concerned about making it perfect and you know. And I realized with this show, that when children looked at the work,
they got it just as much as anybody else.
Yes.
It was definitely. Not like over their head or beyond readable. Mm-hmm. They could read anything, that little suggestion of a human being or a tree or an animal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? They got it. And they could do it themselves if they wanted to. Yes. They didn't have to think, oh, I'm not good enough. It never touches that. So it's a rare adult who allows themselves to create with a language that is not like a spectacular technical ability. It's, what are we trying to say here? What matters?
That's right. And I think you're right about the fact that children came out just as moved as adults. And that's rare for an art show, especially a large-scale retrospective. You know, the fact that it was so inclusive of children. Yeah. I know my children really appreciated that. Yeah. They really had a lot to say. And it really shows his ability to communicate his truth in mm-hmm. such a sort of direct way. And I feel like children often are they're kind of like a good litmus test for an experience, because they don't filter themselves. They'll tell you, oh, that I like that. I don't like that. That's gross. That's ugly. They'll tell you. And it's really, they don't sort of aim to please in what they're saying. And they were affected by this experience. And I think it really, it caused a lot of waves in our community in a positive way. It was moving. It was very moving.
I also know, though, that it was also, some of it was disturbing to people in a not a good way, because Peter's very political and he doesn't hold back. And so at the same time, we live in a country, in a part of the world, where we have to be allowed to speak what we feel strongly about without being slammed into the jail or whatever. And so because his language, because Peter's language is so, it happens mostly visually. I mean, my idea to have this Bread and Puppet presence here, it came simply because I was idly looking at the website of Bread and Puppet during the winter of last year. And I came across the fact that there were these bedsheet exhibitions happening in little cafes and hallways and all over the place. And at one point, the person who is guiding these videos says, if you or anyone else you know of a space where these could come, I'm going, oh my God, oh my God, the creamery is perfect.
Yes.
And little did I know what a thing I was starting, but it was so clear to me. And what I love is that the creamery has always been mostly known around here anyway as a children's art school. So adults don't can make the connection for themselves mm-hmm. with this place. At least I don't think they did most of the time. And now, well, we saw what an incredible effect it had on the community. And we do have a community. And it was leaking beyond our community into a lot of other places. People being drawn because they either knew about it already, knew about the work, or they didn't, but like somehow they got curious. And it brought in people into this space that would never have walked in the door otherwise. And now that's happened. And there's no going back, and I think a lot more is going to happen because that has happened.
Yes.
It's like all the doors got thrown open. It's like
thank you, Vicky.
Well, I remember that years ago, there was a show at the Museum of Fine Arts mm-hmm. in Montreal, and it was going to be a show about cars.
Yeah.
There was such controversy. But no, you can't have cars in the museum. They're not art. And other people, well, yes, they are. I mean, there's engineering, there's incredible design, blah, blah, blah. Finally, it happened. And there were people coming into the museum to see the cars who had never stepped a foot in the museum before. Because art was like, no, thank you. I'm not into that. I don't get that. But cars, let's go check out the cars. And it was an opening as opposed to a selective thing that only certain people. I think the same thing happened with this show.
Absolutely. It's very art for the people and his whole manifesto of cheap art and use the materials that you have. You know, don't, like you said, don't try to achieve perfection in what you're doing, but make sure that you're getting truthful and authentic. And, you know, I think that is very much part of the manifesto.
Well,
it's
making
very evident. Yeah.
Cheap art, making with what you've got, is that has been a huge part of my own work.
I make assemblage out of found objects. I do my dance is grabbing from here and grabbing there. Everything is the people that I work with. I want to work with what they've got to give rather than go, I want you to do this like that. Instead, I know I've got resources all around, whether they're human or they're material, and there's never an excuse for not being able to make something, because there's always something you can make with.
I totally agree with that.
You know, and that's certainly Peter. And so much of the materials that have come through his hands or anyone else there, including the bed sheets, mm-hmm. have been from somewhere else. Nobody went out to an art store and mm-hmm. bought materials and mm-hmm. all that stuff, where you get so, art becomes so narrow under those circumstances. And then, the price gets put on them. And, and are you going to be famous? And, so, I mean, I actually had a couple of people ask me if some of these bedsheets were for sale. And I said, that's not how this works. And Peter does not sell them. They have a book, they have a book press, they have things they do through books and through all that stuff, banners, but the work here, this is not for the museum. And of course, as people know, he created actually a place on his land in Vermont called the Anti Museum.
Absolutely. And I think that there's a great way to also show children how to be inspired by Peter, by, you know, feeling that sense of empowerment and creativity and in the moment spontaneity, which children already have. You know, it's just kind of like preserving that,
yes.
you know, as
yes.
a grown up. Yes. I really want to thank you for taking this time with me. It's been so wonderful. I love that we just kind of took the questions, threw them out the window, and had a really good conversation. And that's the best kind of interview. So I want to say thank you so much, Vicky.
Oh, it's such a pleasure.
Pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much. And I feel so much that we really are a community of a kind, that there's so many people that have contributed to the existence of this place,
mm-hmm.
but, and it's not just existence, but it's ongoing vitality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worked with what's raw and transformed it into what's supportive of the vision that everyone who's here is sharing, some kind of a vision that got started with Anne-Marie and her, you know, you have a big vision, you go, okay, yeah, it's like me with thinking about having this show here.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was, wow, of course. And then it's like, oh my God, it's not going to be easy, but it's going to happen.
Yes, and so many people contributed to lifting up that idea.
Absolutely.
And just giving it, you know, a new
the
life
team
of
in
its
this
own.
School is really impressive, and I know that you've gone through a lot to get to the team you are now, which is makes total sense. And I have been so happy to be part of that team as well.
À travers ces rencontres, on constate que l'art peut à la fois éveiller la conscience et créer des ponts entre les gens. C'est une idée qui trouve un écho particulier chez notre prochaine invitée, Alexis Smith, qui travaille depuis des décennies au sein du Bread and Puppet Theatre et nous parlera davantage sur son travail et l'impact du théâtre.
So, thank you for having me. Thank you for having Bread and Puppet here and this incredible exhibition of Peter Schumann's work and the work of the Bread and Puppet Theatre. So, yes, my name's Alexis. I'm from Vermont, and I have been working with Bread and Puppet almost 40 years now, and as a volunteer. And I am a member of the sort of community company. So I've lived at the theater and with the theater and around the theater for many, many years, touring and performing and doing local work. Normally, my persona as a performer is inside a guy called the Garbage Man, who's on in the exhibition right now. And the character is sort of the everyman, the worker man, and a traditional, iconic, early figure of the Bread and Puppet Theater. And in the circus, he works as the guy that's cleaning up the mess. If somebody falls, if somebody drops some things, I make a shtick. I've got a lot of freedom for kind of creative performance and whatever funny stuff.
Amazing.
So that's the fun times. Mm-hmm. Those circuses are every weekend and then on tour that we travel around the world with. And And then my passion and the work that I do with Peter Schumann as his curatrix. So I am actively taking as much of his painting and work around close to Vermont and Canada as possible. The idea was to move locally around our state and the surrounding New England areas in order to really expose folks locally to Breton Puppet and to the work that he's been making. And this has probably been about 25 of the last 40 years.
Wow, that's incredible.
But in the last 4 years, or now almost 5 years of this pandemic period, the theater was donated right at the beginning of the pandemic, a huge pile of hundreds of bed sheets from like an old hotel that, you know. And so Peter started painting on bed sheets every day, avidly, prolifically, intensely.
That's an incredible amount of energy.
So much. He is just so unbelievably prolific and skilled. So these giant paintings, which are basically like 3 meters by 3 meters or more, a king size, a queen size bed sheets, producing every day for 5 years. I have hundreds of pieces to work with. Wow. So I have been looking everywhere for venues, inside, outside, pop-ups, or permanent, temporary, ongoing exhibition, and finding and meeting Sutton School of Art was just a super huge excitement, because the venue has maybe 40,000 square feet of space inside and outside. So all of the buildings, all of the walls, every nook and cranny, we just filled to the brim with his work. And I tried to bring, usually I tried to bring some three-dimensional objects. So to give you a little background, if people aren't familiar with Peter Schumann. Peter and Elka Schumann founded the Breton Puppet Theater over 60 years ago and started in New York City and moved to Vermont in the 70s. We have a property up in Glover, Vermont, with a huge, beautiful museum that was a lambing barn, a giant timber frame, paper mache, dirt floor cathedral theater, and now a new anti-museum, giant a venue that we just acquired and is filled with hundreds of bedsheets and puppets. So,
and you welcome the community every summer.
Every summer, every weekend. And the museum is open every day, and people can let themselves in, unlock the, turn on the lights, enjoy the show. There's a beautiful Bread and Puppet Press store right in the museum, and there's a cheap art bus. So the philosophy of cheap art, a lot of the puppeteers make their own pieces that Peter don't contribute to, so it's nice to see the works of all the different puppeteers that have come from all over the world to join us. So as we travel around the world, we meet hundreds of artists, people of all ages, who love to come to Bread and Puppet and do an apprentice or an internship or a volunteer position. Some people like to work in the press. Some people like to work in the circus. Some people work in the garden. We grow all our own food. Yeah, we do all of our cooking for up to 200 puppeteers that are working with us in the summer. And these exhibitions are ongoing during the whole year. And so I'm always looking for a new venue. Yeah, I'm always looking for a space to do this work. And then frequently Peter will travel and do a performance with the exhibition. We always serve bread and aioli at every show. We grind all of the rye. Peter has been keeping his family's 176-year sourdough alive since he came after the war from Germany to the States. He came in the 50s and carried that sourdough with him. So this bread that incredible. He bakes in the wood ovens are fresh, and we serve it with every show.
That's amazing. And how did it feel having such a massive show in Quebec? We had the space was incredible, and the crowd, the turnout was really good as well. Did you feel that the French language, there was an understanding of
of the work, and you felt that it was properly received the way that you had hoped?
It was beyond what I hoped. It was beyond what Peter even dreamed. We were astounded at the incredible people holding their hearts as they walked in the door, people crying, people just so, such a powerful emotional and an intense response to this exhibition, to Peter's work. It's so visual. The words are simple. A lot of these woodcuts that he's carved, some of them 10 feet, 2 meters tall, or, you know, several meters wide, these giant woodcuts frequently just have a single word, and it's the images people are looking at. It's the colors on the bedsheets. It's these powerful, often the theme of this anti-war is the main sort of thrust of the work. And Peter is a global understanding of everything. He's quite a genius. He's a baker. Mm-hmm. He's a musician, a composer, a dancer, a choreographer, obviously our director, a mm-hmm. sculptor, philosopher, writer. So we really are blessed to have the experience of his skill and his leadership and a lot of this artistic, beautiful, beautiful artistic impression can be just seen. We do have a Bread and Puppet website, breadandpuppet.org. On that site, there are lists of where current exhibitions are mm-hmm. and how to contact me, breadandpuppetcuratrix@gmail.com. So people can reach out to say, I would love to host one painting, 100 paintings, amazing. A show, yeah. that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm it's really so good happy. To get the word out. Thank you so much, Alexa. Such a pleasure to have you here today as our guest. And we just look forward to seeing what more beautiful exhibition the Bread and Puppet puts on.
Well, thank you for joining us. I just want to thank the Sutton School of Art and Anne-Marie, everybody here, Roger. It's just, Iona, it's been like a heartbreaking and powerful experience. It's been the largest exhibition of the works of Bread and Puppet in our history. And I'm so grateful. I'm grateful to Quebec for warming us here.
Thank you so much. Right,
thank you.
Merci beaucoup, Alexis, d'avoir partagé votre parcours avec nous. L'influence du Bread and Puppet Theatre au Vermont ne se limite pas à la scène théâtrale. Il a aussi profondément marqué l'évolution d'autres formes artistiques, notamment le Cirque du Soleil. Fondé sur des principes similaires d'expérimentation et d'art public, le Cirque du Soleil a grandi en intégrant des éléments du théâtre de rue et de la performance visuelle. Pour explorer cette connexion, nous sommes rejoints par Yves Chérif, historien du cirque et collaborateur du Cirque du Soleil.
D'accord. Alors, je m'appelle Yves Chérif. Je suis, entre autres, commissaire indépendant en art vivant, et puis j'ai travaillé longtemps au Cirque du Soleil, au casting, puis aussi dans les équipes de création. Et donc, j'ai eu le bonheur de connaître Justin Croix quand il travaillait là, et puis de l'interviewer souvent sur les débuts du Cirque du Soleil. Et comme je suis aussi en histoire de l'art, ben, c'était quelque chose qui m'intéressait. La naissance de cette compagnie, d'où c'était né, c'était quoi les racines. Et c'est évident que pour Jim, qui a toute une histoire, on prendrait des heures là, pour faire connaître toute sa vie, mais le Bread and Puppet Theatre a été un événement marquant pour lui. Donc, je suis content d'en parler un peu.
Oui, merci. C'est super intéressant, en fait. Et c'est vraiment, est-ce que ça a initié les tout débuts du Cirque du Soleil ou pour vous, comment s'est passé?
Je suis rentré en 2004. Le Cirque du Soleil existait déjà depuis un bon 20 ans. Il est né en 84 comme tel à Baie-Saint-Paul et à Québec. Mais si on recule plutôt que ça, l'équipe autour de Guy Laliberté, Guy Caron et Gilles Sainte-Croix étaient plutôt des saltimbanques ou des amuseurs de rue qui étaient à Baie-Saint-Paul. À Baie-Saint-Paul, il y avait un petit endroit qui s'appelait le Balcon Vert, et puis c'est là que Gilles Sainte-Croix travaillait, puis qu'il a accueilli un jeune cracheur de feu qui s'appelait Guy Laliberté. Mais si on recule encore plus tôt que ça, Gilles faisait partie à Baie-Saint-Paul du club des Talons Hauts qui l'été animait les rues de Baie-Saint-Paul par par une grande fête. Et ce que Gilles me racontait, c'est que il vendait aussi des pommes. Il y avait des versets dans le coin. Et puis les pommiers étaient assez hauts, donc il fallait chaque fois prendre l'échelle, passer d'un pommier à l'autre, comme on fait souvent dans l'université. Mmh. Puis Gilles a eu cette idée de se faire des échasses, puis de cueillir des pommes comme ça d'un pommier à l'autre. Alors c'est plus facile pour lui. Puis quelqu'un lui a dit, hey, tu devrais aller voir, il y a un groupe qui sont installés au Vermont, des chasseurs qui s'appellent des châtiers, pardon, qui s'appellent les Bren Puppet Theatre. Et Gilles est allé les voir, et puis c'est là qu'il y a eu la révélation. Il est revenu de cette expérience complètement changée. Mmh. Il a dit, ben là, on va faire une fête. Ça va s'appeler le Club des Talons Hauts. Donc, on comprend pourquoi maintenant que ça s'appelait comme ça. Et puis, plusieurs, Carmine Ruet et d'autres, se sont mis sur des grandes échasses et ont inventé ces grands personnages. Gilles Sainte-Croix était intéressé d'ailleurs à Alexis le Trotteur à ce moment-là. Il avait créé une pièce autour de cette espèce de personnage mythique québécois qui faisait des grandes enjambées et qu'il pouvait personnifier en échasse. Donc, le Bren Puppet a été vraiment à l'origine de l'élan créateur de Gilles pour vouloir créer cette espèce de communauté, aller plus loin que simplement être des amuseurs, mais créer un spectacle. Puis ensuite, du spectacle, avec l'arrivée de Guy, ils ont décidé de faire un petit cirque qui s'est appelé rapidement ensuite le Cirque du Soleil. Et puis, de là, le reste est devenu histoire. Ben, il travaillait que l'été, donc Gilles est retourné voir le Bren Puppet, je crois, au moins deux ou trois fois, okay. Qu'il me racontait. Et puis, à chaque fois, c'était toujours très intéressant. Il a offert, entre guillemets, à lui et sa jeune gang, au Bren Puppet, je crois, un petit spectacle qu'ils sont allés faire là-bas, si ma mémoire est bonne. Mais c'était vraiment, pour lui, quelque chose de très important. Puis le petit Cirque du Soleil, qui travaillait que l'été, ben, ils se sont dit, ce serait bien qu'on puisse continuer à travailler l'hiver. Ils ont demandé des subventions. Puis finalement, j'y vais très vite. Ils sont partis en Californie, en Ontario au début, puis ensuite en Californie. Et puis c'est là, en Californie, qu'ils avaient que l'argent pour y aller, mais pas pour revenir. Donc, il fallait que ça fonctionne. Et finalement, étant donné que c'était un cirque sans animaux, tranquillement, hein, ça s'est pas fait du jour au lendemain, le public là-bas a commencé à aller les voir, et puis là, l'équipe c'était beaucoup plus importante, avec Franco Dragon, avec Stéphane Roy d'ailleurs, qui habite dans votre coin. Mm. Et puis c'est ça. Donc voilà, pour en revenir, le Bren Puppet était pour Gilles vraiment, vraiment une indication très claire de ce qu'il voulait faire comme plus tard dans ses...
C'est extraordinaire, merci. Comme il y a un côté très politique au Bren Puppet, et je me demande si ça a aussi rejoint Gilles, ce côté-là, ou c'était plus le côté performance.
Très bonne question, en effet. Mais ce que je pourrais dire, c'est que c'était, je dirais, les deux. C'est-à-dire que la forme que le Bren Puppet Theatre faisait avec Peter Schumann, de faire ces grands, grands personnages, ça, c'est clair que ça l'a vraiment influencé Gilles. Mais également, faut comprendre que Gilles, c'est un idéaliste, c'est un hippie de cette époque-là au Québec. Il vivait dans des communes. Le Québec était bouleversé beaucoup par cette génération de hippies, de façon de vivre qui était. Et puis, évidemment, il y avait un côté politique, je dirais plutôt social, de vouloir mettre de l'avant la liberté de création, la liberté de vivre. Mm-hmm. Et c'est sûr que ça le rejoignait. Gilles était jeune dans ce temps-là. Sauf que ça le rejoignait aussi dans ses convictions. Maintenant, le Bren Puppet est beaucoup plus associé aussi au début à la guerre du Vietnam, donc un côté pacifique que Gilles a voulu garder. Il faut comprendre quand on analyse quand on fait une radiographie du Cirque du Soleil, malgré le côté très commercial qu'a pris la compagnie plus tard, mais c'est un côté commercial quand même qui a toujours voulu défendre l'idée de la protection de la terre. Mmh. Donc, dans la plupart des spectacles, là, c'est assez facile de voir des signes pour défendre surtout la terre, donc environnementaliste, faire attention à notre planète, etc. Donc, et ça vient probablement des racines très lointaine, profonde, mais très solide de ce petit groupe-là là, autour de Baie-Saint-Paul, de Gilles, Carmen, Guy La Liberté, Guy Caron. Ça a toujours été le message important, Gaïa, la terre nourricière. Et puis ça, évidemment, ça rejoint aussi le Bread and Puppet Theatre, parce que aussi ils avaient évidemment là où ils sont installés, et aussi là où était installé le Cirque du Soleil au début. Il y a aussi une corrélation entre deux communautés qui ont décidé de ne pas vivre en ville et de vivre à la campagne. Donc ensuite, ouais, l'histoire s'est a évolué autrement ensuite après, mais ça reste ça fondamentalement quelque chose de très, je pense, de très évident de voir que la protection de la nature et de la terre, et c'est un message qu'on retrouve dans les deux communautés et aussi au Cirque du Soleil, encore aujourd'hui. C'est un message encore qui est très important pour le cirque.
Mais merci beaucoup Yves, c'était un plaisir de discuter avec vous. Dans cet épisode de Portrait vivant, nous avons exploré l'univers créatif du Bread and Puppet Theatre, une source d'inspiration pour l'art engagé et collectif. Nous avons vu comment l'art peut devenir un miroir de nos luttes, un moyen d'expression poétique et radicale, et comment il façonne le paysage culturel, tant au Vermont qu'au Québec et ailleurs dans le monde. Merci à nos invités pour leur contribution précieuse et merci à vous, chers auditeurs, de nous avoir rejoints pour cette exploration de l'art en tant que force vivante capable de transformer le monde. À bientôt pour un nouveau Portrait vivant. Ce projet est rendu possible par le gouvernement du Canada ainsi que le Fonds canadien de la radio communautaire.